1. Knowing our culture. The gospel lives always in conversation with culture, for the eternal word never ceases to be present to the church and to humanity. If the church holds back from culture, the gospel itself falls silent. Pope John Paul II. David Foster Wallace told the story of two young fish who were swimming along when they pass an older fish swimming the other way. The old fish nods at them and says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" The two young fish swim on for a while until finally one of them looks over at the other and asks, "What the hell is water?" The point of the story is that the most immediate, ubiquitous, and important realities are often the hardest to see. We're the young fish. Rather than ask, "How's the water?" we want to start with a more basic question. What's water? In other words, what reality are we immersed in? The Southern writer Flannery O'Connor, a keen observer of culture, once said, "If you live today, you breathe in nihilism. In or out of the church, it's the gas you breathe." That was in the 1950s. What about today? What are we breathing or drinking? When children want to know how to name something, they point to it. "What is this?" they ask. This is a demonstrative word. We use it when something is so close to us that we can hold it in our hands, point to it, or demonstrate its presence. It's a key word in the institution of the Eucharist. "This is my body," because it points to a present reality, the body and blood of Jesus. It's far more difficult, though, when we are immersed in something. There's not a distinct object to point to. This pervades every aspect of our life, to the extent that we might not even think about it. Look around. Stick your finger in the air. Point at the air you breathe, the information you consume, and the taste of life on your tongue. It's this. This is our water. Liquid modernity. The culture of liquid modernity has no populace to enlighten and ennoble. It does, however, have clients to seduce. Zygmunt Bauman. We're living in an age of liquid modernity, according to sociologist Zygmunt Bauman. Everything is fluid, from identity to truth. There's angst and uncertainty about the future. By midnight, we could be out of a job, out of a relationship, or out of battery life on our smartphone. In this ocean of uncertainty, what can we cling to? In his Introduction to Christianity, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI, likens our situation to that of the main character in the play The Satin Slipper by Paul Claudel. Pirates loot the ship of a worldly Jesuit missionary and tied him to the mast of his sunken ship. The play opens with the missionary floating on a small piece of wood over the raging waters of the ocean, fastened to the cross, with the cross fastened to nothing, drifting over the abyss, writes Ratzinger. In liquid modernity, personal vocation is the cross that each person is fastened to. It's the way that each person puts down roots in eternity, uniting himself to the cross of Christ, which is planted firmly in heaven. Culture develops on solid ground, where people can put down roots. The word culture comes from the root cultus, which originally meant tending or cultivating soil. It can drown in too much water. Meanwhile, the waters rage. If we don't understand the currents, we risk getting caught in the riptide. There are three very strong currents that make the work of cultivating vocations a challenge. They contribute to the crisis in vocations, but that's okay. The word crisis comes from a Greek word, krinion, which implies decision, judgment, and discernment, all foundational elements of vocation. So, let's enter into crisis. First, we live in a culture of calculation. Liquid culture loves numbers. They flow freely, and they can become whatever we want them to be. There are three kinds of lies: lies, damned lies, and statistics, wrote Mark Twain. Yet our culture prides itself on objective decision-making through statistics. It falls prey to the illusion of complete certainty. A few years ago, the bachelor CEO of a billion-dollar company told me that he was considering getting married, but he had one problem. He was a calculator. He looked at me seriously with a hint of sadness and said, "If you can prove to me scientifically that I will be happier if I get married, then I will get married." He's still not married. Second, we live in a culture of disincarnation. According to the philosopher Fabrice Ajaj, it's the crisis of fake wood. First, we make laminate, then plywood, then particle board, then plastic with imitation wood grain. Finally, we put in a liquid crystal display, LCD screen on a MacBook Pro, and have a beautiful forest as our desktop background. We're undergoing the great liquidation of everything solid, wood, flesh, relationships, families, and faith. Third, we live in a culture of conformity. Water takes the shape of the container that holds it. Our liquid culture is like a giant ice cube tray that never gets cold. We shake it, and the water sloshes around from compartment to compartment. Lacking solidity, people flow easily into new cities, ideologies, and identities. Leo Tolstoy began his novel Anna Karenina with the line, "Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." Vocations are the opposite. All saints are happy in different ways. Each one lives out his personal vocation by finding his unique happiness in God. All sinners are unhappy in the same way. They choose not to respond to the call of God and live without the only thing that could make them truly happy. A culture of calculation. Life is not a problem to be solved, but a mystery to be lived. Gabriel Marcel. On opening night of the 2002 baseball season, Oakland Athletics fans had bacon fat dripping from their beards. They love their bacon-wrapped colossal dogs there, and confidence brimming over their beer cups. The A's had been on a baffling tear for the past three seasons. They made the playoffs each year and took the New York Yankees to the brink of elimination twice, even though the Yankees outspent them by $86 million. Something strange was happening in Oakland, as one sportscaster put it. Jeremy Giambi kicked off the game with a line drive single to left field off of Texas Rangers pitcher Chan Ho Park. Perhaps not a wave-worthy hit, but Giambi did what the A's did best. He got on base. That year, the A's touched first base another 2,132 times, a .339 on-base percentage, and went on a 20-game winning streak, something no American League team had done in the history of baseball. The eccentric general manager of the cash-strapped Oakland A's, Billy Beane, had spent the past three seasons crafting a team that found gritty ways to win. Shortly after taking over the job in 1997, he implemented an empirical approach to evaluating players. He hired statisticians to bracket out all the fluff, the beauty of a player's swing, or his marketability, and evaluate players based purely on the numbers that win baseball games. Things like weighted on-base average and batting average on balls in play. The emphasis on statistics was so serious that Beane and his staff were suspicious of in-person interactions with new players for fear of being swayed by non-objective measures. Though Beane used sabermetrics very effectively, he did not develop or name this approach. But it was so successful that other teams eventually adopted the system, and it spawned the entire business of sports analytics. In 2003, Michael Lewis wrote a best-selling book about the rise of sabermetrics called Moneyball, The Art of Winning an Unfair Game. The book was so popular that it was eventually made into a movie starring Brad Pitt as Billy Beane. Thus, the term Moneyball entered the general lexicon. And that's how baseball, the romantic game of summer nights filled with peanuts and Cracker Jacks and cold beer, became a calculated affair. For many people, life had already become one. Playing the cards we are dealt is part of the American consciousness. Books and blogs about life hacking, tips, tricks, and shortcuts to increase efficiency and happiness are some of the most popular. Lewis' book was a success, not only because he's a good storyteller, but because he told the same story that we are already living. Life, the art of winning an unfair game. The poker game of discernment. God is not a sadistic poker player. Yet this is the image that many young people unknowingly have of him. He holds the cards of our lives in his hands. He knows the secret to our best life and true happiness, but he won't tell. We don't even know if he's holding a good hand or a bad hand. Worse yet, he might be bluffing. Those who don't believe that they have a vocation, or that there is even a reality called vocation, still have to contend with him. Their poker player simply deals in desire. Which desires lead to fulfillment, and which lead to emptiness? He'll never tell. A human being has thousands of conflicting and competing desires nearly every day. Without grace and virtue, and especially without a clear idea of where he's going, he has no way to order them. Desires can deceive, and nobody is better at deception than a good poker player, especially a sadistic one. This mentality makes decision-making torturous, even when a choice is between good things. When I go to a restaurant, I sometimes get menu anxiety. I don't want to order the steak if the place is known for its fish. And how do I know whether the special seafood salad is delicious, or just a clever way to get rid of old fish? If you hand me a wine list, things get even more complicated. I don't like to make poor choices. How am I supposed to know whether the Lebanese Syrah is overpriced relative to Super Tuscan? After I choose, I want to hear the words, good choice. If I have this much anxiety over mundane choices, how much more anxiety do I have over the cards that the sadistic poker player is holding? My life is in his hands. I fear hearing the words wrong choice come from his cold, gray lips before he lays down his hand and laughs. But Jesus doesn't greet people in heaven with good choice. In the parable of the good steward, the master says, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little, I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master." Matthew 25, verse 21. The Lord is not out to trick us. He is the good shepherd who desires our good, and he will lead us to that good if only we would follow him. Indeed, he is the good. This is why Jesus tells his servant to enter into the joy of the master. He tells the Samaritan woman at the well, "If you knew the gift of God," John chapter 4, verse 10. Vocation is a gift from God that brings joy to those who receive it. Today, recognizing the gift requires a new kind of openness. The gift that opens. Some gifts are meant to be opened. Other gifts are meant to open us. How can we know the difference? There's evidence that our Western culture may not easily grasp what is given. In his book, The Master and His Emissary, Ian McGilchrist shows that there has been an increasing reliance on the left hemisphere of the brain over the past few hundred years, a result of Cartesian dualism, the Industrial Revolution, technology, and other factors. As a consequence, we live a more calculated life, relating to the world in a way that is suspicious of gifts. Calculated living prefers earning, not receiving. It's the world of Moneyball and poker, not falling in love. The right brain, the master, is an open system where we take in new experiences, seeing the whole rather than the parts. It's where we wonder. The left brain, the emissary, is different. It's a closed system that operates within the boundaries of what is perceived. It likes certainty more than adventure, maps more than metaphor, mechanisms more than living things. New experiences are represented. The left brain takes data from the right brain and processes it. It fits experiences into categories, frameworks, patterns. The two hemispheres of the brain see the world in radically different ways, but they have a partnership. The right brain gives us a way of seeing the world that is open to the dynamism of new experiences, and the left brain gives us a way to find meaning and structure in those experiences. As the right brain takes in new aspects of reality, the left brain constantly revises its models in order to make sense of what it is receiving. There's a feedback. But what happens if the left brain becomes dominant? Then we live in a society where new, unexpected experiences can't be fully received, and we're left trying to understand the world in bits and bytes of fragmented information without their full context. Donum, gift, becomes data. the left brain is good at calculating thought, and the right brain is good at meditative thought. Calculating thought is always concerned with how to reach its objective. How can I win more games? How can I win this poker hand? It calculates options. It assigns values. It maximizes the chances of winning. Meditative thought is patient thought. It doesn't look immediately for solutions. It doesn't calculate options or project itself into the future. Instead, it remains in the present and sinks deeper into it, allowing reality to unfold. It asks questions like, what present is this? Why is it here? How did it get here? What does it hide? What does it reveal? What does it mean? The right brain likes to wonder more than calculate. And it's only with this meditative habit of being that we can earnestly enter into another story, even our own. Wonder is the attitude that people have in the presence of Jesus in the Gospels. The Greeks called the object of this wonder pteros, which means something beyond all expectation. If people expected something from God in first century Palestine, it certainly wasn't Jesus of Nazareth. The incarnation of the Son of God didn't just surpass expectations, it shattered them. This is God's style. Grace is the gift beyond all expectation. God eludes our best efforts to wrap our minds around him, and grace breaks into our lives in unexpected ways. In Flannery O'Connor's writing, grace is never a pious sentiment in a pew, but something more like an unexpected punch in the face, sometimes literally. The calculating mind simply can't experience anything beyond all expectations. It can only manipulate what it has already received, putting it into a box or category, and calculating what to do next. But when we approach life with meditative thought, wonder, we find that each person, indeed, each thing, is truly beyond all expectation. A culture of disincarnation. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Job, chapter 34, verse 22. Wilson Bentley was born in the winter of 1865. On a farm in Jericho, Vermont, the heart of the Snow Belt, as the Civil War was drawing to a close. Nature captured his imagination from a young age. He studied spiderwebs, grasshoppers, caterpillars, and anything else he could get his hands on. He loved to show his mother his new discoveries. He'd catch a butterfly and run home with the tiny creature tickling his palms. In the winter, Willie was obsessed with snow. What is it? What does it look like up close? Why does it melt so quickly? He caught snowflakes in his hands and on his tongue, but they always melted before he had a chance to study them. Willie's mother, Fanny, was a former schoolteacher who noticed and nurtured his sense of wonder. On his 15th birthday, she gave him an old microscope that she had used in her classroom. Willie was ecstatic. He could finally study all of his small discoveries in depth, especially snowflakes. Willie stood outside in sub-zero weather and caught snowflakes on a black tray. Then he quickly placed them under his microscope. He tried to draw them, but he only had a few minutes to look at them before they melted, never long enough to capture the full design. The beauty and complexity of each snow crystal was beyond anything that he ever expected to see. Each crystal had six branches that were exactly alike, but each crystal seemed to be completely different from every other crystal. Willie realized that he needed some way to capture the unique designs that he saw, or else his discoveries would be lost to the world forever. When he was 15, Willie read about a new product from the Bausch & Lomb Optical Company that combined a microscope with a bellows camera. He thought that it might be the key to unlocking the mystery of the snowflake, but it cost almost $100. Which was an enormous sum of money in the late 19th century. For months, Willie begged his parents to buy it for him. His father balked. The instrument cost as much as his entire herd of cattle. How could he justify spending that much money to look at snowflakes? His mother, knowing her son's genuine desire to share what he had seen, interceded on his behalf and prevailed in convincing her husband that it would be good for their son. Before the end of the year, Willie's parents made the sacrifices necessary to buy the equipment. Even with his state-of-the-art equipment, snowflakes were elusive. On the coldest of days, Willie had only 6 or 7 minutes to get a photograph before the snowflakes melted. Finally, after 4 years of repeated failures and modifications to his equipment, Willie had a breakthrough. On a stormy day in 1885, he developed his first negative photograph of a snowflake. He could share the miracle of beauty that had captivated him since his youth. In the 46 winters that remained in his life, Wilson Bentley photographed over 5,000 snow crystals. It became his life's work. He invested over $15,000, but received less than $4,000 in compensation for his photographs. This didn't bother him. "The recognition has been very gratifying, but not very remunerative," he wrote. "I am a poor man, except in the satisfaction I get out of my work. In that respect, I am one of the richest men in the world. I wouldn't trade places with Henry Ford or John D. Rockefeller for all their millions." Wilson became one of the world's most recognized experts on snow and a pioneer in the field of photomicrography, the photography of small objects. Throughout his life, he gave away hundreds of photographs as gifts and made slideshows of snowflakes for children in his neighborhood. Toward the end of his life, he gave most of his remaining photographs and study notes to universities and private foundations. In November 1931, Wilson compiled 2,500 of his best images in a book. In it, he wrote, "Under the microscope, I found that snowflakes were miracles of beauty, and it seemed a shame that this beauty should not be seen and appreciated by others. Every crystal was a masterpiece of design, and no one design was ever repeated. When a snowflake melted, that design was forever lost. Just that much beauty was gone without leaving any record behind." A month after the book was published, Wilson walked 6 miles home during a snowstorm to the same farm where he was born, contracted pneumonia, and died 2 weeks later. He was buried at Jericho Center Cemetery under a small gravestone with 3 words on it: "Wilson, Snowflake Man." Grasping Snowflakes. The wonder of Wilson Bentley's vocation is that he probably never thought about vocation at all, at least not theologically. He simply did what Annie Dillard describes in her essay, Living Like Weasels. "We can live any way we want. People take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, even of silence, by choice. The thing is to stalk your calling in a certain skilled and supple way to locate the most tender and live spot and plug into that pulse. This is yielding, not fighting. A weasel doesn't attack anything. A weasel lives as he's meant to, yielding at every moment to the perfect freedom of single necessity." Wilson located his most tender and live spot, grabbed hold of it, and never let go. He rarely left his small family farm in Jericho, but his life was charged with adventure. He discovered the grandeur of God in a snow crystal, and he shared it with others. Would Bentley have taken the time to contemplate a snowflake if he had been born today? We'll never know. Now students can plug into Google Maps and see the entire world with the click of a button. They can explore the structure of a snowflake from the comfort of an iPad. They don't have to submerge their ankles in snow until their toes go numb. Philosopher Michael Polanyi wrote that it is not by looking at things, but by dwelling in them, we understand their meaning. Wilson Bentley dwelt in the snow of the Vermont snow belt for over 60 years, long enough for it to reveal its secrets. How long are we willing to dwell with the people we meet? Learning from nature. On a winter afternoon in 2017, I went to visit my co-author, Joshua, at his home in Toronto, Ohio, near the small university town of Steubenville. We paid a visit to his friends, Sean and Beth Doherty, who live on a family-scale sustainable farm in eastern Ohio. The Dohertys started the farm in 1996 on a piece of land that was deemed unsuitable for agriculture by the state of Ohio. They didn't know much about sustainable farming at the time, but they knew that they were the type of people who might enjoy watching bluebirds look for nesting holes in pasture fence posts or gloating over the red, squirmy worms in a half-cooked pile of compost. Sean and Beth struck me with the colorful language that they used to describe things. Their desire to farm was not driven primarily by sustainability, veganism, or food sovereignty. It was about paying attention to grass, the texture of a calf coat, and the challenges of winter chicken culling. I didn't ask them, but I imagined that they would like Richard Wilbur's poem, "Love Calls Us to the Things of This World." The title speaks for itself. An abstract, disincarnate world is full of limitless possibilities. But are more theoretical options always better? The population of bean beetles and cucumber bugs on the Doherty's farm are things. They demand attention. "When we give ourselves in commitment," Beth said, "it takes away the necessity of choosing between a more or less limitless set of possibilities. We find that we receive back things like time with our family and time spent marveling at the color of the summer wildflowers." Sean and Beth see the incarnate world, in all of its specificity and limitations, as the secret to cultivating a healthy sense of their own humanity. By choosing to raise their family while caring for a small piece of land in the hills of eastern Ohio, they are powerfully focused on a concrete mission that organizes their lives. "The power of a river is in its banks," Beth said. "If you take away its banks, it spreads out and becomes a lazy lake. But if you keep the banks firm, give the thing form, there's a lot of power behind it." The first thing that I noticed when I visited Sean and Beth's farm was their naturalness, which is a forgotten virtue in our technological age. Naturalness comes from nature. It can't be manufactured. There was no pretense, unlike an urban food startup that recently welcomed me with a PowerPoint presentation about their revolutionary social entrepreneurship in food agriculture. Beth greeted me with coffee. Sean and Beth work hard, and they love what they do. They're revolutionizing their piece of land. In cultivating the soil, they're cultivating a way of life, a culture of conformity. The evil of our times consists in the first place in a kind of degradation, indeed, in a pulverization of the fundamental uniqueness of each human person. Karol Wojtyła, St. John Paul II. A 1985 commercial begins with a van pulling up to a beach on a sticky 92-degree day. Loudspeakers pop up from the roof. Inside the van, a bushy-haired, smiley-faced young man hops from the driver's seat into the back, which happens to be a fully outfitted recording studio. He pops the cap off a cold bottle of Pepsi a few inches away from a microphone, and the sound is amplified over the speakers. Sunbathers hear gas bubbles popping lusty gulps of soda, and a long, drawn-out, "Ah, pure refreshment." Everyone on the beach rushes toward the van. Then the driver-turned-Pepsi-drinking recording artist hops out, puts on a hat, and starts handing out bottles of ice-cold Pepsi to the parched crowd. The commercial closes with the slogan, "Pepsi, the choice of a new generation." The irony is that the people on the beach don't appear to have any choice at all, and Pepsi knows it. The commercial is one of the first examples of advertising that is self-conscious. It makes fun of itself. But there's a subtle trick. Brad, who works 50-hour weeks as an entry-level accountant and took Marketing 101 as an undergraduate at Wake Forest University, watches the commercial from his couch and feels like he's in on the joke. He has transcended the masses that Pepsi targeted in the commercial. He's not like them. He has choices. Then he goes to the store and buys more Pepsi. Pepsi knows what every con man knows. The moment when people are the most comfortable is the moment when they are most easily seduced. Just when Brad thinks he's free of manipulation, he's most open to the next cold beverage truck that pulls up. It might be full of Pepsi, or it might be full of liberalism, socialism, populism, or some other thirst-quenching ism. The French philosopher René Girard calls this a consequence of mimetic desire, or the imitation of what others desire. It starts at a young age. At a birthday party, 5-year-old Kelly grabs a balloon and shouts, "This balloon is mine!" Suddenly, that balloon becomes the most coveted balloon in the room. Connor, playing with his big red truck, doesn't find it entertaining anymore because Kelly, with the perfect bows in her pigtails, loves her balloon so much. When they grow older, the mimetic rivalry may not be over balloons, but it will endure. The mimetic mechanism is present in schools, restaurants, relationships, and every other domain of human life. According to Girard, it's also present deep within the human heart. There's no escape from this condition. There's no option of nonconformity. The question is, to whom or to what will we conform our desires? If we don't know, Pepsi does. Hashtag conform to me. Our culture celebrates the free, autonomous self. Yet we have a stultifying lack of differentiation. From the industrial-produced tomatoes on our tables, to the cultural narratives that produce a chorus of politically correct phrases and opinions on college campuses, a homogenizing force is sweeping through our society. Our technocratic, mass-produced culture has resulted in an alarming degree of sameness. When a person severs ties with the moral, cultural, and religious history that shapes our world, he trades the divine creativity for his own. He wants Hamlet without Shakespeare. He wants Bob Dylan without folk music. In his short story, Unaccompanied Sonata, Orson Scott Card imagines a boy, Christian Haroldson, who is a musical prodigy in a dystopian society run by authoritarians who control every aspect of society, including every person's vocation. At 2 years old, his seventh battery of tests pinpointed the future he would inevitably follow. Christian would be a maker of music. In order not to spoil his creativity, government authorities lock him in a cabin so that he can make truly original music. Christian is prohibited from listening to any other music that might corrupt his originality and make his music derivative. One day, though, he secretly discovers Bach, and through Bach, he begins to discover himself. When the watchers, the authorities, find out that Christian's originality has been corrupted, they forbid him from ever making music again. And so he tries to repress his irresistible, insatiable desire for musical expression. Christian eventually takes a job as a deliverer of donuts to grocery stores. One evening after work, he wanders into Joe's bar and finds a piano. At that moment, his desire to make music overwhelms all of the forces conspiring against him to stay silent. He sits down and plays the piano in a way that astonishes Joe, the bar owner. He played as pianos aren't meant to be played. The bad notes, the out-of-tune notes, were fit into the music so that they sounded right, and Chris's fingers, ignoring the strictures of the 12-tone scale, played, it seemed to Joe, in the cracks. He exercised his freedom in a culture of conformity. But soon after, he pays the consequences. The watchers find him. One of them took a laser knife from his coat pocket and cut off Christian's fingers and thumbs right where they rooted into his hands. That's how a vocation dies. Forces of conformity. Who are the watchers in our society? They don't cut off fingers and thumbs. They're far more subtle. We can get an idea of how the watchers, the forces of conformity, shape our world by looking at education, agriculture, technology, and language. First, education. The American education system is a funnel, and students who want to excel in it are forced to conform if they want to come out the other end. Sir Ken Robinson, an expert on education and author of the most watched TED Talk of all time, says that our education system has mined our minds in the way that we strip mine the earth for a particular commodity. The result has been a massive stunting of creativity. Many young people grow up striving to produce exactly the right type of resume that will allow them to become productive members of society. They face batteries of standardized tests, interviews, and assessments to ensure the integrity of the commodities that our increasingly specialized world is looking for. Second, agriculture. When man thinks that he is master over nature, even fruits and vegetables must conform. Biodiversity is decreasing rapidly. If a teenager saw the variety of Brandywine tomatoes in my mother's garden, he could be forgiven for thinking that something is wrong with them. Some of them look like monstrosities, with their bumps and lumps and color variations. He's used to seeing large beefsteak tomatoes in supermarkets that are mass-produced on industrial farms in Florida and look like they came off of an assembly line. From the outside, they look like bright red ornaments that I could hang from my Christmas tree, and that's what they taste like. The Florida Tomato Committee has strict controls about which traits their tomatoes must possess. Flawlessly smooth skin, evenly round shape, and consistent size. They are rejected if the shape and coloration doesn't conform to standards. And if biting into one of these uniform tomatoes doesn't produce mouth-watering satisfaction, that's okay, as long as they look like they should. Third, technology. According to a new study by Common Sense Media, teens spend an average of 9 hours every day using media. Evidence already suggests that smartphone usage is linked to skyrocketing rates of teen depression and suicide. Today, the peers to whom they compare themselves and model behavior are not simply the 25 kids in their 8th grade classroom. They are the millions of teens bombarding them with Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook posts at all hours of the day and night. This has led to a widespread globalization of ideas, values, and structures that used to be formed in the home, school, and community. Tech companies have tremendous power and influence. Amazon heavily shapes how people shop, Google how they acquire knowledge, and Facebook how they communicate. Twitter allows 1 million or more people to echo the exact words of another throughout the world within a matter of minutes. In 2016, 16-year-old Carter Wilkerson authored the tweet with the most retweets in history. A request to win free chicken nuggets at Wendy's with the tweet, "Help me, please. A man needs his nugs." It was retweeted over 3,650,000 times. By contrast, one of Pope Francis' most popular tweets, "Every life is a gift," hashtag March for Life, was retweeted about 22,000 times. It's easier than ever to follow people and ideas and propagate things we like. And it's a strange world where one man's quest for chicken nuggets is 165 times more interesting than the Pope's words about the dignity of every human life. Finally, language. The conformity of language, which shapes the way that we see the world, is a problem inside and outside of the church. Inside the church, we use terms like vocation in an equivocal way. We apply it to the calling of every person, and then exclusively to priests and religious in the next breath. And we can rattle off platitudes like, "everything happens for a reason," without taking the time to understand the person we're talking to. Outside of the church, people are told what to do, what to eat, how to think, and how to speak. An Orwellian manipulation of language is becoming commonplace. For instance, someone who disagrees with the government's new use of the word marriage is quickly labeled an ignorant bigot. Back in 1993, David Foster Wallace already noticed the dangerous way that mass media and advertising were shaping language. He bemoaned the state of fiction writing. Almost all of the popular new writers were mimicking the irony they saw in television. They were afraid to be serious. But in their quest for clever irony, writers were falling headlong into a cesspool of cheap marketing tactics. Wallace wrote, "The next literary rebels in this country might well emerge as some weird bunch of anti-rebels who treat of plain old untrendy human troubles and emotions in U.S. life with reverence and conviction." In a culture of conformity, we need more than rebels. A rebel becomes a reflection of the very culture that he sought to rebel against. Instead, we need men and women with a transcendent purpose to achieve, with a personal vocation. Saints aren't defined by what they are against, but by what they are for. They are anti-rebels par excellence. The anti-rebel. In 1916, at the age of 18, Dorothy Day dropped out of the University of Illinois and moved to the Lower East Side of New York City. She abandoned her girlish interest in religion and fell in with a bohemian crowd that hung out in bars and coffee shops around Washington Square Park. She drifted naturally towards socialism. In her autobiography, she confessed to the temptation to solve everything with politics at that time in her life. "I wanted to go on picket lines, to go to jail, to write, to influence others and so make my mark on the world," she wrote. Dorothy spent most of her 20s throwing herself down different avenues, looking for a vocation. She took part in protests and marches, got arrested twice, and finally found work as a journalist at the radical left-wing newspaper The Call for $5 a week. Over the following years, she drifted aimlessly. At one point, she worked as a nurse at a Brooklyn hospital, where she met Lionel Moise, a womanizing newspaper man, and eventually became pregnant with his child. Moise told Dorothy to get an abortion, and she did. Dorothy continued to fight for social justice and to write. Her novel, The 11th Virgin, was published and optioned for $5,000 by a Hollywood studio. But she eventually became so ashamed of it that she tried to buy up every copy. David L. Brooks, in his book The Road to Character, writes that Day was taking a stand against injustice, but she was doing it without an organizing transcendent framework. She seems to have felt unconsciously, and even then, that for her, activism without faith would fail. Dorothy began to realize that her activism and self-creative ambition, which was divorced from any living relationship with the infinitely creative God, was making her a worldly conformist. Instead of conforming to Jesus Christ, she was conforming herself to a political party, to an ideology, to the passing moment. Dorothy sold the movie rights to The 11th Virgin and bought a beach house on Staten Island. She soon found a new lover, an anarchist and biologist named Forrester Betterham, who visited her at her bungalow on Staten Island almost every weekend for 4 years. Once again, Dorothy became pregnant, and this time gave birth to their baby girl, Tamar. The birth of her daughter marked a profound change in Dorothy. She was overwhelmed with a sense of gratitude. No human creature could receive or contain so vast a flood of love and joy as I often felt after the birth of my child. With this came the need to worship, to adore. Dorothy began to pray again for the first time since she was a little girl. She stopped rebelling against worldly power and started rebelling against sin. When it came time for her to find a spiritual home, she turned toward the Catholic Church. Her attraction to the Church didn't come from its political or social clout. "It was the people, not theology," writes Brooks. "It was the Catholic immigrants she had covered and served, their poverty, their dignity, their communal spirit, and their generosity toward those who were down and out. Her contact with the poor was the most credible witness to the truths of the faith." Dorothy found the Church, and in it, she found her vocation. In 1938, she published an account of her conversion in a book titled From Union Square to Rome. In it, she wrote that she would try to trace for you the steps by which I came to accept the faith that I believe was always in my heart. Dorothy stopped rebelling and started responding to the deepest desires of her heart, to the word that was buried deep within it from the beginning. The Catholic worker movement that she founded is still thriving today, with more than 240 communities in the U.S. and overseas committed to nonviolence, voluntary poverty, prayer, and hospitality for the homeless, exiled, hungry, and forsaken. toward a culture of vocation. A fresh and courageous perspective is needed to foster a culture of vocation. Because we live in a culture that is anti-vocational, a vocational culture is necessarily countercultural. It fosters meditative thought rather than calculating thought, prefers to touch a person rather than talk about an idea, and cultivates the freedom to imitate Christ rather than men. We know that no vocation is possible without the grace of God, yet grace is outside of our control, and talking about it too much can reduce it to something that we think we understand better than we do. We can't control God's grace, but we can dispose ourselves and others to it. Father Herbert Alfonso, S.J., in his excellent book, Personal Vocation, says that the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius are about discerning one's personal vocation, which is founded on one's nature, one's unrepeatably unique and specific way of actually disposing oneself for the Lord. Father Alfonso humbly admits that God's grace is something outside of our control, beyond all expectation, but we can and we must learn to dispose ourselves to it based on our unique nature. We propose a simple approach. Listen to people's stories in order to help them discover their unique motivational design. This gives them a hermeneutic, or interpretive key, to understanding their continued discernment. Then, in the light of faith, accompany them as they discover and embrace their unrepeatable call. Mentors have front seats to this unfolding of God's design. In the climactic meal of Babette's feast, General Lawrence Loewenheim, who earlier in Isaac Dinesen's short story had become jaded by unrequited love and wrote off the world as cruel and unjust, is overcome with gratitude for God's mysterious design. He escaped a life of dealing with the sadistic poker player. During a meal with his old friends, including the woman who once spurned him, he becomes an instrument of grace for others. In the middle of the meal, after realizing that grace has broken into his life, and emboldened by a few glasses of Clos de Vougeot, 1845, he stands up to make a toast. We have all of us been told that grace is to be found in the universe, but in our human foolishness and short-sightedness, we imagine divine grace to be finite. For this reason, we tremble. We tremble before making our choice in life, and after having made it again, tremble in fear of having chosen wrong. But the moment comes when our eyes are opened and we see and realize that grace is infinite. Grace, my friends, demands nothing from us but that we shall await it with confidence and acknowledge it in gratitude. God's grace is an ocean, and we need only let ourselves get wet. To the question of the old fish, "How's the water today?" we can answer with confidence, everywhere.